Wearing this shirt, is that it'll remind you of the good old days when you were watching on the computer, and it looks kind of like I'm pixelating, maybe a little bit. I don't know how this day has felt for you guys. It's kind of felt like riding a bike again, where you hadn't ridden it for a while, and it just kind of feels like this is what we do. This feels right. Hopefully not too foreign. It's been a good day to be able to be with God's people in the morning and now tonight as well. We're going to be starting a series of lessons in the book of Ruth. Whenever I preach on a Sunday night, I'm always just preaching through books of the Bible. And we're going to be beginning this series of Ruth just by looking at chapter 1. So we're not going to see the totality of what happens at the end of the book, like the songs that we just led were about. But that's where we're heading in the next few lessons on Sunday nights. So you can be opening your Bibles to Ruth chapter 1. The coming of Jesus into this world wasn't like a meteor. It wasn't something that just crashed in suddenly. It wasn't like a flash of lightning. But what you see in the Old Testament is you see the bloodline of Jesus being preserved through common, ordinary people. And wedged in between the books of Judges and 1 Samuel is you've got this little booklet called Ruth, that not only shows the part of the bloodline of Jesus, but also has characters that seem to imitate Jesus. And we'll say some things about that as we go through this series. But I think about Boaz at the end of this book, an Israelite man marrying a Gentile woman. How many of us here tonight are Gentiles? And how many of us can say that we are part of the bride of Christ? We'll be working our way towards these things as we go through this. But I think I'll be doing 3 or 4 sermons on the book of Ruth whenever I'm preaching on a Sunday night. But I just want to show this just as we get started here. Here's a chart. I'll show this a couple times as we go through this. There's a couple ways that you can remember the book of Ruth. You can remember it with 3 A's, where chapter 1, what we're looking at tonight, is affliction. And then this is the affliction that Naomi and Ruth endure and go through, that kind of set up the providence of God that you'll see throughout the rest of the book. Chapters 2 and 3 deal with the affection that Ruth and Boaz have for each other, and then they acquire each other as husband and wife in chapter 4. In chapter 1, most famously, you see this choice of devotion that Ruth makes towards being with Naomi and how that gets tied to her relationship with God. And so that's going to be the chapter that we're going to look at tonight. I'll show this chart again, so if you don't remember all that right now, that's fine. Let's go ahead and read the totality of Ruth chapter 1, and this will be the text that we look at tonight. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his 2 sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi. And the names of his 2 sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there, but Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she left with her 2 sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth. They lived there about 10 years. And both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her 2 sons and her husband. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So she set out from the place where she was with her 2 daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her 2 daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. But Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts me from you. And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, is this Naomi? She said to them, do not call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi, when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me? So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. As we begin to look at this chapter, I think I want to say a couple things here about the setting of this book. First of all, the setting of the book of Ruth within the context of Scripture. The first couple words in the book of Ruth is in the days, or are in the days. There's only one other book in the Bible that begins with that phrase, in the days. And it's the book of Esther, in the days of Ahasuerus, king of Persia. Here, it's in the days where the judges ruled. But these books, Ruth and Esther, are oftentimes studied together. Maybe for obvious reasons, they're both named after a woman. People who say that God and the Bible are sexist. It has two books in the Old Testament where God is apparently most misogynistic that are titled after women, that hold women up in a positive kind of way. But I think this invites us to look at some contrasts and comparisons to the book of Esther. Let me just show you a couple of them here. Ruth was a Gentile, and Esther was a Jew. Here's another one. Ruth was a Gentile living among Jews, but Esther was a Jew living among Gentiles. Ruth married a Jew, but Esther married a Gentile. God is mentioned in Ruth many times, but God is not mentioned in the book of Esther. Now, there's a lot of contrast and there's a lot of similarities. What would be some of the similarities? In the book of Ruth, you've got the bloodline of Jesus being traced through this Moabite woman. But in the book of Esther, you've got the whole bloodline of all the Jews being saved by Esther. So all of these things end up looking towards Jesus, and those are maybe some things that there's more that we could say about that, but that's maybe some things to say about the context in the greater canon and how it relates to another book. But notice something else about the setting of this. In the days when the judges ruled. And as soon as you see that phrase, you think about some of the darkest, most wicked times in Israelite history. Where the refrain at the end of the book was that everyone did what was right in his own eyes. This was in a time period where the Israelites had no kings, and everybody was just kind of doing what they thought was best in their own eyes. And what happens throughout that book is that there is nations that would put them into subjugation, and God would send these military deliverers. And so this book takes place in the midst of that. When you read the book of Judges, actually, when I was in college and I took a Bible as literature class, I was already starting to preach. But I didn't know for sure if this was going to be what I was going to do. The book of Judges was a huge influence for me. That when you look at the corruption that happens when people don't acknowledge a king, if there's something that I can do to help people realize that there is a king, and that maybe they can live in accordance with him, that book was an encouragement to me. But if you just read the book of Judges, you see mainly a lot of wickedness. But in the book of Ruth happens during this time period. Do you ever feel like we live in really dark days? How could we ever fight against the influences around us? The book of Ruth is going to show a story of a worthy man. Boaz is called a worthy man. And Ruth, who's called a worthy woman. And this affection that they have for each other. And this godly marriage that they enter into. And the way that they serve God together. And the way that Boaz serves God in the fields and the job that he has and things of that nature. So this is taking place in the days when the judges ruled. Notice something else, though. That in this particular time, there was a famine in Ruth chapter 1, verse 1. I don't know where that places the book of Ruth within the book of Judges. I'm not sure if it was when Gideon was around because there was some famines that were going on there. I'm just not sure. But does that remind you of anything that the Old Testament ever talked about? That if there was famine in the land, what must that have meant according to Leviticus, according to Deuteronomy? Here's a little picture of this. Leviticus 26, verse 26. God is saying, I'm going to curse your land if you guys disobey. And one of the things that he says he's going to do is, when I break your supply of bread. Which is precisely what's going on when we get into the story of Ruth. A wicked time period, there's a famine going on. And through all of this, like in the book of Esther, we're going to see God providing for his people. Now, one other thing before we think about this scene that we're looking at right now. The book of Ruth is going to say a lot about the Moabites and the Israelites, and it was already mentioned a couple times in the first chapter. But what's so significant about Israel and Moab, and the fact that there's going to be a marriage between somebody who is of Israel and somebody who is of Moab? What do we know about the Moabites up to this point in Scripture? You remember how they began? Incestuous origins? When Lot leaves Sodom and Gomorrah, and his daughters get their dad drunk, and they bear children, and the Moabites come from that relationship, which makes them distantly related to the Israelites. So they've got an incestuous origin. Do you remember that story of Moab and Balaam? When the Israelites are on the cusp of the promised land and they've destroyed Og, king of Bashan, and some of these other nations around them, and the Moabites get scared, so they hire Balaam to try to curse God's people. That doesn't work. And so then what Balaam does is he encourages the prostitutes of the Moabites to go and seduce the men of Israel. So if you were to think about a man marrying a Moabite, just in Israelite history, do you think that's going to settle well with a lot of people? Most recently, the Moabites had been subjugating Israel. Remember Eglon, king of Moab? Do you know what the name Eglon means, by the way? It means fat cow. And do you remember how he dies? Because that's what he was. And so, that was 18 years of being subjugated by the Moabites. Alright, so with all of that in mind, I want you to try to imagine what's happening here in this chapter. Well, this famine is happening. We focus on a family of four people, Elimelech and Naomi, their children, Mahlon and Chilion. And they were from this town called Bethlehem, 6 miles south of Jerusalem. Now, the name of the city Bethlehem means house of bread, and it's ironic because the house of bread has run out of bread. And while they're there, this famine hits. I'm not exactly sure the context of it, but can you imagine what it would be like to live in the midst of a famine? When we lived in Nashville, there was like the possibility of snow, and all of the food was wiped out of Trader Joe's. Just because of the possibility. Do you know how much we rely on the trucking industry? And what if something, just one small thing happened to the trucking industry? Do you realize how weak we are? What would it be like to live in the midst of a famine where you're really not sure where your next meal is going to come from? And you've got Elimelech looking at his kids. I'm not sure how old they are, but they're looking like they're losing weight. They're looking pretty skinny and scrawny, and they need to get some food. And so they decide to go to Moab. So they go across the Jordan River. They trek all the way over there. I don't know what that conversation was like. When Elimelech goes to Naomi and says, hey, we're going to move. And she goes, okay, well, where are we going to go? Well, we're going to go to Moab. The people that just put us into subjection, those women seduced our men in the book of Numbers. You remember all of that? Yeah, well, we've heard that they have food. And here goes Naomi. Do you suppose Naomi had dreams and visions of how her life was going to look? That she was going to be married, and she was going to have kids, and she would have grandchildren, and she was going to have this nice, comfortable life in the land that she was supposed to live in. Well, shortly after they get to Moab, Elimelech dies. The text doesn't tell us how it happens. There's no details given. But after Elimelech dies, the two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, they marry Moabite women. How do you think Naomi could be feeling at this point? Not only did we move here and my husband dies, but now my sons are marrying Moabite women. I'm not sure what was going on in her mind. By the way, we know at the end of the book which one marries who. Ruth the Moabite was the widow of Mahlon. That means that the other one married Chilion. And so here they are married and they're living there for 10 years. And then Mahlon and Chilion die. Again, we're not told how that happens. Although Mahlon and Chilion, those names mean something like sick and dying. Which I don't know if that would be like, so I take it that they die from some kind of disease. It would be like today naming your kid Rona and Delta or something like that. I'm not sure. But it seems like based on their name, they probably died from some kind of disease. Can you imagine the heartbreak that Naomi is facing? And then it says in verse 6 that she's working, she's in the field, and one day while she's in the field, she hears that God has visited. Notice that word visited in verse 6. We'll revisit that in a little bit. That God has visited Israel. And that he's brought food to them. And so now she sees this as an opportunity to go. So she starts out with her two daughters-in-law, Ruth and Orpah. And as they start going, it seems like Ruth changes her mind. Can you imagine the emotions of the possibility that they're actually going to go back home? And here's Naomi, and she says, just go back and find rest where you guys are from. The Lord's going to take care of you. And these women raise their voice and they weep. And they indicate that they want to stay with her. But Naomi doubles down. She says, no, you need to turn back. If I had a kid in my womb right now, would you wait to be able to marry that kid? I have nothing to offer you in earthly terms. I can't give you more another person to marry. You go back home. The Lord bless you in your territories. I don't know what her tone of voice was. I don't know how firm she got. But it was firm enough for Orpah to kiss her mother-in-law goodbye. Kisses her, and you can imagine Orpah starting to walk down the horizon, down the road, and she kind of passes in view, and she just drops off the pages of Scripture at that point. But at the same time, here's Ruth, and she's clinging to her mother-in-law. By the way, that same word for cling, like clinging to her, is used in Genesis chapter 2 about a husband and wife cleaving to each other. Same kind of imagery. And she's grabbing onto her. And she says, your sister-in-law has left. You go. What do you think was in Ruth that made her say famously that where you die, I will die. Where you go, I will go. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. She just says insistently, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to be there with you. She's got a one-way ticket to Bethlehem. Have you ever tried to convince somebody otherwise and you just know that you can't? There comes a point where you got to go, okay, well, if that's what you want to do. So Naomi, the two of them, start heading to Bethlehem. What do you think that trip was like? I don't know where in this travel that conversation happened. I don't know if it was 2 miles down the road or 40 miles. I don't know. But what do you think the rest of the trip was like back to Bethlehem? Do you suppose that Ruth was starting to wonder, hey, like, I don't know how much I'm going to be appreciated by these people because they know what my people have done to them. Do you think that Naomi is being very talkative? It doesn't seem like she is very much. But can you imagine being Ruth and Naomi and you get closer and closer to the city, you see the city gates and you're Ruth and you're going, all right, this is where I'm going to live now. And as soon as you walk in, everybody's just like this. What do you think it would be like to have everybody whispering about you? And everybody's going, is that Naomi? And they're not even talking about Ruth. Do you notice that they're not even, they're just, oh, she might be a Moabite person. Let's just ask about Naomi. Is this Naomi? Is this Naomi? And all she's hearing is, Pleasant is back. That's what her name means. Pleasant is back. Don't call me Pleasant. The Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. Call me Mara because I'm bitter. I can imagine when she says this, everybody just kind of quiets up and backs off a little bit and goes, remember your house is over there? I think there's some cobwebs in there. They return at the beginning of barley harvest. God's already brought food back to the people. But this chapter that's filled with sorrow and death and things like bitterness ends with this high note of this possibility that there's going to be grain available. Now, we'll stop in the story there and pick up in chapter 2, but I want to draw some lessons just from what we see in this first chapter. I think if we look at Naomi and we look at Ruth and then we think about God, who's the big character of every story, that we can learn some practical things for us to consider from this chapter. I want to start out with Naomi and consider her lament. Is it just you, or is Naomi a complicated person in this text? There's some things about her that are obviously not very good, and there's some things about her that are pretty good. And it's kind of hard to figure out, well, what do we make of somebody like this? In that same Bible as literature class that I took in college, some of you heard me say this story somewhat recently, but my college professor said that as we were studying through the Old Testament, he said at a secular school, somebody who wasn't a Christian, he said of all the books in ancient literature, there's no other book that has more literary realism than the Bible. And I raised my hand and I said, what's literary realism? And he said that the Bible portrays people the way that they really are, with their complexities. What do you see going on with Naomi? She's telling her daughters-in-law, go back to your homelands where your gods are. Well, that's not very good. She's saying that God has dealt bitterly with me. Are we sure about that? I don't know. She's accusing God of certain things, it seems. But at the same time, she's talking about God and knowing that He's the Almighty. It seems like there's some good things about her, but she's not perfect. Does that kind of sound like all of us? Sounds like the Bible's got a lot of literary realism. But I want to point out something about the lament of Naomi. Because what we see, the words that she says here, are similar to things that we see in other parts of the Bible dealing with this concept of lament. Here's one definition of lament that I really like by Paul Miller. A lament grieves that the world is unbalanced. It grieves at the gap between reality and God's promise. It believes in a God who is there, who can act in time and space. It doesn't drift into cynicism or unbelief, but engages God passionately with what's wrong. There are so many books in the Bible. Well, there's so many psalms in the book of Psalms that are lament. The book of Lamentations is lament. When Job loses everything, he laments the day of his birth. What is it that Naomi here is lamenting? In verse 13, before she gets back to Bethlehem, the Lord's hand has gone out against me. And then she has the rest of the trip to think and meditate. And when she gets all the way back to Bethlehem, in verse 21, she's still saying, call me bitter. The trip didn't change her mindset totally. And maybe you see some things in that that are maybe concerning. But do you notice what she's doing here? Two times when she gets back to Bethlehem, what term does she use for God? She uses two terms two times for God. She calls Him the Almighty, and she calls Him Lord. Covenant term, Lord. And then she acknowledges Him as Almighty. You know what's impressive to me about Naomi with these other things that you could be concerned about with her? Has she used all the suffering that she's gone through as an excuse to walk away from God? Or in the midst of it all, does she say, there is an Almighty God, and I don't know what's going on. Things seem unbalanced, and she's, I assume, praying these things to the Lord as well, even though she's saying these things in conversations with others? Do you have anything in your life to lament? Does it ever seem like this world is unbalanced and that there's a gap between the reality and God's promises? Even with your own spiritual growth and maturity, you never feel like you're fully where you want to be. Are there things to lament? 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 7 says, casting all your anxieties on Him because He cares for you. Whatever you want to see as being problems with Naomi in this chapter, what you're going to see throughout the book of Ruth is you're going to see her growth. This is where she is right now. She hasn't stopped the conversation with God, though. And that's when you have to get concerned. That's also true for Job, by the way. That all throughout the book of Job, Job says some things where he went too far. But do you know what he never stopped doing throughout the whole book? He keeps praying. He keeps acknowledging God as Almighty. Have you stopped acknowledging that about God? That's the first thing, is the lament of Naomi. When was the last time that you poured your heart out to God and you told him how you really felt about something? And maybe that's the pathway to helping us grow through certain things. Notice the second thing is the decision of Ruth. I like this. Ruth is one of the Old Testament conversions. You've got several of them in the Bible, some of David's mighty men. This is one of them. I like this quote from Daniel Hawk. He said, "Famine drove Naomi to Moab. Devotion brought Ruth to Bethlehem." That when she's deciding to go back to Bethlehem, to go to Bethlehem for her first time, this is set in contrast to Orpah. Does what Naomi say to Ruth sound a little bit like the kinds of things Jesus would say, especially in the Gospel of Luke? Where he would challenge people that he tells a crowd, if you want to follow me, you've got to hate your father, mother, brother, sister, wife, even your own life, and you've got to renounce all that you have. He would say challenging things to people, weeding them out. I'm not sure that that's exactly what Naomi's doing, but it reminds me of that a little bit. And even in the face of Naomi telling Ruth, no, don't do this, go back to your gods, she says no. Now, there's a couple of things that she is committing herself to, where she says, I'm going to flip it in verse 16, where she says at the end of verse 16, your God will be my God. The Moabites worshipped Chemosh. Chemosh was one of the gods that wanted child sacrifice. But can you imagine living in this land and everybody appreciates Chemosh? Because 15 years ago, there was this battle that took place, and Chemosh, we all worshipped him the way that we ought to, and because of that worship, Chemosh brought us the battle, and from growing up, you had a little children's book about Chemosh, and all these, like, this was what you grew up with. And you're leaving all of that behind because, I'm not sure exactly why, I'll have an idea about that in just a second. But the challenge for us would be, are there any things that we've been distracted with recently that we've been putting above God in our devotions? Did anybody struggle with putting politics above God this last year? It seems like that's what everybody wants to talk about now. Anybody struggle with putting self-centeredness or just your own pleasure or some ideology above what God says? All right, that's, I think, a familiar thing that we've seen with Ruth. But I want to notice what she says at the beginning of verse 16. She starts out by saying, your people will be my people and your God will be my God. I think it's really important to notice that Ruth acknowledged that this is a package deal. That if I am going to serve the Lord, that puts me into the community of God's people. She's not a Lone Ranger Israelite. She knows that if I'm going to worship God, that puts me in community with these people, and these things are never to be separated. Think about this in your life. Would you say, Jesus is your Lord? Okay. Who are your people? Who's your people? If you're one political persuasion, is it those people that share the same political persuasion? If you really like this sports team, like I like the Philadelphia Eagles, I got nobody here. If it's some favorite sports team or favorite kind of music, who are your people? You realize that if we say that we've committed ourselves to Christ, and we look around this room and we say equally, you are all my people. Do you suppose that when Ruth came to Bethlehem, that her new tribe, her new people, glared at her ever? Do you suppose that they ever misunderstood her and where she was coming from? Do you suppose that there were differences from their background and all these different sorts of things? Are there differences in this church? Economically, ethnically, socially, politically, whatever. But you got a passage like this in Colossians 3:13, bearing with one another, and if one has a complaint against another, forgiving each other as the Lord has forgiven you, so you also must forgive. I see Ruth living this out. She marries an Israelite. How are we doing with this, bearing with one another? I have to say, in the 2.5 years that I've been here, it's been such a blessing. I've heard horror stories of what has happened in the last year in other parts of the country, and mask and no mask and this or that and every the unity that that this church has been blessed with has been amazing to see that. But this church has got some things in the future, the building. And are we all going to see that the same way? Probably not. But are we able to bear with one another and maintain unity in the midst of all of that? If Jesus is your Lord, these are your people. And Ruth got that. What was it in Ruth's heart that helped her see that? Maybe, I'm not sure, this is speculation, but maybe Naomi played some role. Where again, you see some problems with her. But she's still acknowledging God as Almighty. She still knows the Lord in the midst of her trials. Have you ever seen somebody go through something difficult and they walk away from God? And then by contrast, you see somebody else who goes through something really difficult and they can still say, the Lord is the Almighty One. He's the one that's in control of it all. I don't know what the future is going to look like. I don't know if Naomi's, if you want to call it weak faith or whatever you want to call it at this point in the book, was that enough to influence Ruth? I'm not sure. Maybe. But I want us to finally consider the providence of God in this chapter. The book of Ruth has no miracles in it. The book of Esther has no miracles in it. But what both of these books show is God's providence. If you think about, first of all, how is God providing? Let's just start with Naomi. How is God providing for Naomi in this text? First of all, there's grain. It's come back. Look at verse 6 again really carefully. When she arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So she catches wind somehow or another that the Lord visited. Do you know, can you think of any other times in the Bible where somebody says the Lord visited Israel? I think about Zechariah in Luke chapter 1, verse 68, where it's this prediction about what Jesus is about to do. And about the coming of Jesus, he says that the Lord has visited his people. What's interesting here in Ruth chapter 1 is the Lord has visited his people and brought them bread. When Jesus came, what did he bring? He's the bread of life. He's the one that has provided grain. And if you have felt like you've been in a famine the last 10 years, did this last year and a half feel like 10 years? Anybody here putting something above the Lord and you're in a famine because of that decision? Has the Lord provided anything for us that'll help us get out of that famine? And is it going to take some work for us to get there? Are we going to have to do some traveling to understand what these things mean in my life and really apply them? But has he provided something for us that feeds us and meets our deepest needs? He has. Notice what else he's providing, though, for Ruth, is he's providing friendship. What he's providing for Naomi is he's providing friendship. The name Ruth means friendship. It's better than Lambda or Delta or whatever, Malon and Kilion. Lambda's the other strain that came from South America, I think, that they're worried about, too. I don't know. Anyways, so friendship. Naomi has provided friendship. This Ruth, this Moabite, is going to stick with her. And in the next three chapters, this friendship that's forged is going to be the thing that provides Naomi the very things that she was worried about not having in chapter one. But think about I've been studying with a new wave of skeptics, Nate Creekmore and Dave Hamlet and Noah and Clara and Danny Campbell have been coming to these. And one of the things that the new wave of skeptics that I've been studying with, one of the things that they say, because we're comparing, okay, which worldview gives you meaning in life and a reason to be moral, and the Christian worldview's got all the resources and everything like this. And one of the things, like, they try to fight those things, but one of the things that they're very quick to acknowledge is we do not have community. We walked away from God, our conception of God, we have no sense of community. And skeptics and people in the secular world have tried to get it based on their favorite sports teams or what, you know, all these other things that we might be saying, these are my people. There's no depth of community. One of the things that Naomi's being provided with after she's lost her husband and sons is friendship. How much have we looked at one another and the deepest relationships we have with one another as God's providence in a lonely world? Notice the third thing. What he's providing for Ruth, which she doesn't know at the moment, our blessings in the future. This chapter, as we said in verse 22, ends with the beginning of the barley harvest, which indicates that there's going to be blessings in the future. And for Ruth, it's not just going to be the food. It's going to be Boaz in this relationship that they develop into, and the way that he's able to provide the things that she needs. She needs food and she needs a husband. And she's going to be able to have those things provided for her by God. It's in her future. You think about our future. In this world that we live in that's filled with wickedness, like the days of Judges, that's filled with so many people experiencing some kind of famine, that for us who have Jesus as Lord and these are my people, do we have a blessed future where we're going to be married to the King one day? And our destiny is going to be away from all of these things that are perishing and all these things that cause heartache and tears. Maybe in a microcosmic way, we see some of those things in the book of Ruth, just in the first chapter. But Ruth doesn't fully understand everything that's about to happen. We'll put a pin in this series right now, but next time I preach on a Sunday night, we'll be looking at Ruth chapter 2. But maybe you're here right now and you're experiencing some kind of a famine. Maybe you're the one propagating the days of the judges and you're doing whatever is right in your own eyes and you are forcing yourself into a famine. The Lord has provided grain. He's provided a community. He's provided a real hope that you can set all of your hopes into and it won't dash your heart. He's provided all these things for us. He set them all on the table. Are you willing to come and dine with Him? We're about to sing the song, Sweet Are the Promises. Can you say that honestly, that all of your hope is set fully on Jesus? If you can, sweet are the promises. If there's anybody that has any needs, please come forward while we stand and while we sing.
Sweet are the promises, kind is the word. Dear are the many as His man never heard. Pure was the mind of Christ, endless I see. He's a great example is and pattern for me. Trust in His promises.